Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. It's the LA Steel Show. Tonight, I'm going to reread, actually, what it is. It's reread. But I'm going to read the first two chapters of my latest book, my new book, Naked at the Mic, and The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And this is it's been revised, but I have the it's coming out. I don't know if anybody listening is on Facebook or not, but I have a copy of the book on Facebook, the actual proof of the cover and back of the thing. The book should be out, I'm hoping, by the end of the month. I was hoping to make it before Christmas, but I don't know if it's going to be out by Christmas, according to the publisher. But we're trying. And I hope you'll enjoy that. Anyway, this is the first two chapters of the book, and I know that people on Facebook have been listening because I have an unbelievable number of visits recently to the site, to the blog talk and listening, as well as a lot of people on my Facebook. And I want to thank everybody for that and for joining me. And I hope you will continue to do so. And we should have some really interesting stuff for you coming up in the very near future. But right now, tonight, keeping with tradition here, we're going to be doing some reading. And I have I'll just begin. It's basically a quick synopsis at the beginning of the book. It's called Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. Naked at the Mic is an autobiographical account of the establishment of the LA Steel Liberal Talk Radio Show and the events and people that led to the program's survival and success on commercial radio since March 4th, 2003. The chapters and subsequent essays accurately describe personal perspectives on the political and social events of 2000 through to 2009 and offer a critical and often satirical analysis of the demise and defense of liberalism in America. The events and news items mentioned in this book were personally witnessed and reported on the authors with television, radio, and internet broadcasts, or written and published by the author on his website, lasteelshow.org. Section 2 of Naked at the Mic is entitled Essays and Insights. It is comprised of 166 essays and insights selected from over 500 published works from lasteelshow.org. And the essays and insights in this book have been divided into six sections: national politics, international politics, satire, mainstream media, patriotism, and metaphysics. All statements of facts made in this book are verifiable in audio recordings of specific broadcasts from the lasteelshow.org audio archives at blogtalkradio.com/lasteelshow.org, and credit documents or excerpts of books, articles, or items as quoted are throughout the entire text as they appear relevant to the topic or essay. And this book is dedicated to Lila. And those of you who follow my show regularly know who Lila is. She is my co-host and partner in life. So, we will begin. The table of contents. Of course, an introduction. Chapter 1 is Chaos, Crisis, Content, and Criticism. Chapter 2 is the stupidity surrounding the Iraq War. Chapter 3 is Ronald Reagan, the president of the cult of conservatives. Chapter 4 is a smorgasbord of Democratic presidential candidates. Chapter 5 is the assassination of liberalism. Chapter 6, the censorship and 9/11 truth. Chapter 7, Jesus was a liberal. Chapter 8, New Collar Republicans. Chapter 9, The Theft of a Nation by Deaf, Dumb, and Blind Liberals. Chapter 10, The Creation of the Radical Underground. Chapter 11, Moment of Radical Realization. Chapter 12, The Public Relations Princess of the Political Left. Chapter 13, Environmental Menaces from the Right and Left. Chapter 14, Going to War with Iran. Chapter 15, Times Are Changing. Chapter 16, Politics and Metaphysics. The second part of the book, the book is actually 351, I believe, pages. And the second part of the book is called The Essays and Insights. I also have 25 picture inserts in the center of the book, divide the two sections. And the pictures are from the many people that have been involved with our show. The owners of Q103, manager, Lila, of course, myself, and Bill Marshall, who's deceased now, and George Dixon has a picture in there. And a number of the people we've interviewed over time, Saki Trizin and Ramsey. Just a number of people. There's 25 pictures, so it's quite it's there. And if anybody is on Facebook, they can go to my site. It's under Leo Steele. And definitely, if you're if you're listening or like to be a friend of mine or so on Facebook friend, I'd be honored to have you as one. Just send me an invite. And I'd be happy to accept. I'll begin in the introduction. O believe as thou livest that every sound that is spoken over the round world, which thou oughtst to hear, will vibrate on thine ear. And that's a quote from The Oversoul, Conduct of Life by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson has always inspired me, and that particular phrase, that sentence always struck me, especially as a person who talks for a living and hoping people will hear. And there's a truth to that statement that confounds my imagination always. Because I know that when I'm meant to hear something, I hear it. Just like everybody. So whoever's listening to tonight, you can be sure that you were meant to hear this. It was 0 degrees in D.C. on January 28, 2003, but Lila and I were warmed by our anger and the anger of 500,000 committed and courageous American patriots marching together in one remarkable display of democracy and First Amendment rights. The invasion of Iraq was going to happen. We all knew it. But all we could do was be there to shout and march. Few, if any, of us realized that what would become of the U.S. Constitution and the nation in just a few short months. It was a day later, on January 29, 2003, when we arrived home, and we realized the American free mainstream media was completely controlled by the Bush government. They totally ignored the largest gathering of anti-war protesters in Washington, D.C., since the Vietnam War protests. Every media warmonger was fully exposed to the world as they heralded the Iraq War from every radio and television studio in the country. Idiots, criminals, thieves, and hypocrites of the worst kind were given the run of the media as pundits. The propaganda push was everywhere, and any intelligent, liberty-loving, liberal American was lashing obscenities at his television, radio, and newspaper. Every patriotic, peace-loving American was horrified and stupefied by the pro-war conservative insanity they were hearing and seeing coming from the mainstream media nonstop every hour of every day. I had been on statewide television for 4 years and had a popular weekly series, but I was determined to be on radio to combat the right-wing war insanity that was taking over this country. Phil Donahue was canceled by MSNBC. Ralph Nader was all but silenced and demonized by the Democratic Party for driving a stake through in their heart during the 2000 campaign. He exposed their hypocrisy, incompetence, and criminality to the merciless effects of truth in the light of day. There was no one broadcasted nationally or locally who would stand up against the neocons and the conservative call for war. Every major commercial radio and television station was being ethnically cleansed of any liberal anti-war commentary and replaced by conservative radio contract killers hired by the broadcast news networks to destroy all common sense and liberal thought in America. A study sponsored by the Democratic Party in 2003 stated that of all commercial radio stations nationwide, there were 3,000 hours per week of conservative talk radio and only 80 hours per week of liberal talk radio shows. I was determined that the LA Steel Show would be on a commercial station and it would be a viable program worthy of commercial sponsorship. I was convinced that there were sponsors who would stand up for free speech and liberal ideals. Chapter 1. Chaos, Crisis, Content, and Criticism. My first broadcast aired on Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m., March 4, 2003. It was a two-hour in-depth interview with international journalist and human rights watcher Keith Herman Snow. I had a five-minute break at the top of the hour and a few pre-recorded advertisements and weather reports. Joe Lavero, the station manager, engineered the first show. I arrived at the station at 7:30 p.m., expecting Joe to be there and expecting to meet Keith. At 7:30, Joe hadn't arrived yet, and Keith hadn't either. I was as nervous as a cat on a barbed wire fence as I waited outside the dark studio. By 7:45, Joe hadn't arrived yet. There was no sign of Keith anywhere. 15 minutes before the first live broadcast of the LA Steel Show, I was standing outside a dark station, radio station, without a guest and wondering if it was Tuesday night. Was it March 4th, 2003? Was my watch wrong? Maybe it was running fast. Maybe I was dreaming the entire event. Maybe something happened to Joe. Maybe something happened to Keith. Maybe I was losing my mind. Suddenly, Joe drives into the driveway, parks his car 5 feet away from me, opens the car door and says, "Sorry, I'm a little late." I was worried and disheveled, but I could have kissed him. It was real. I was going to be on the air in 10 minutes. Then Joe asks, "Where's your guest?" I paused a minute and realized I wasn't home free yet. "I don't know," I replied. "Do you have anything else you can do?" Joe asked. I replied, no, I don't. Joe thought quickly, then said, "Well, we can always cut the show early. If he doesn't show, you can read the news or do something, play music or something." I knew Joe was nervous as he opened the station door. It was 7:55 p.m. The show started at 8 p.m. Joe went to the control board, set up the mics, and checked the sound. He looked at me nervously and asked, without expecting an answer, "Are you ready? Sit down at the board. Your music opening has started. You start in 30 seconds. Don't talk too close to the mic. You're on in 15 seconds. Keith still hadn't arrived, and it was now 8 p.m. My music intro had started, For What It's Worth, by Buffalo Springfield. I was on live and said, "Good evening, and welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. This is the first show of what I hope will be many. I am L.A. Steel, your host." At that second, Keith walked into the studio and whispers to me, "Sorry, Leo, I was at the restaurant next door eating supper and lost track of time." I was so happy to see him, I gave an audible sigh of relief, then stated with absolute confidence, "Please welcome my guest, Keith Herman Snow. Keith is an investigative journalist and human rights watcher recently back from the Congo, where he has been investigating the atrocities occurring in that region of Africa." Keith was well prepared and kept on track with the most fascinating accounts of his adventures for the 2 solid hours. I'd filmed a television show with him earlier that afternoon, and I was well prepared to discuss many aspects of Keith's work and his extraordinary adventures in many parts of the world. Keith Snow and I had two things in common. We liked each other, and we had our articles edited by Gary Pontefiello, the Voice news editor. The Voice was the first sponsor of the L.A. Steel Show, and the first paper to publish my many rants. It also ran Keith's hard-hitting investigative work. To date, Keith has published regularly in national magazines and journals. He has received 4 Project Censored Awards for writing some of the most censored investigative reporting in the U.S. After the first show, Joe Lavero was impressed enough that he paid for an engineer to run the board. To keep the 2-hour show running smoothly, the rest was up to me. After the first show, I felt secure enough to ask Lila Wood to join me. Lila hosts and co-hosts many of my television programs, and I was waiting to see if it was safe for her to join me on the second show. Lila is far more liberal in her views than I am. She has many heartfelt beliefs and, like myself, was extremely opposed to the Bush administration and the Afghan and Iraq wars. Lila began working with me in 2000 on my weekly cable access program and enjoyed the opportunity to use her talent as a very good interviewer. She has the ability to disarm the most rigid guests and diffuse the most heated arguments. She is the cooler head on the program, which many of our listeners and viewers have told me they appreciate. The night of the show, of the second show, which was March 11th, 2003, was the first night of the gathering of our group. I introduced Lila, and together we introduced Starman Bill Marshall. Bill was a cosmobiologist. This may have been the first time anyone knew there was a cosmobiologist in the world, and I proudly flaunted it to anyone who was listening, that we had one of the few cosmobiologists in the world as a regular on the L.A. Steel Show. Bill had achieved vocal recognition as an astrologer in February 2001. The Litchfield County Times, a regional upscale newspaper, featured Bill in his prediction that the United States would come under attack in the fall of 2001. Bill made this prediction based upon the chart he did of G.W. Bush's inauguration. Bill had a long-running show in Long Island during the late 70s and early 80s with acclaimed Long Island talk show host Joel Martin. Bill correctly predicted Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 on the Joel Martin Show, was later hired as a regular guest. Bill died on Good Friday, 2007. Greatly miss him. He was a good friend. The evening of our second show, our first guest was Catholic worker Jackie Ellen Dussel. Her husband, Christopher, was delayed on his mission in Iraq. She and her family lived in Hartford, Connecticut, and opened their home to the poor and homeless. Christopher is involved in the international outreach of the Catholic workers and was to be on the radio show that night. He was detained in Jordan while arranging for passports for several Iraqis who were seeking asylum to the U.S. to avoid the inevitable attack on Baghdad. Jackie was obviously worried, and her concern brought great tension to the interview. I was grateful for her speaking to us. Several days later, Christopher returned home safely. He was met at his front door by 4 FBI agents wanting to know why he was in Iraq. I booked him for the following week's radio show and recorded a television program with him that same week of his arrival. One would think that for a second show, this would have been enough to adequately fill a 2-hour program, but not the L.A. Steel Show. My third guest for that evening was a phone interview with my good friend and anti-nuclear activist Joe Besaid, who had just finished filming a DPUC meeting in New Britain, Connecticut, where he and several other activists went to speak before the commission to prevent the enacting of the plan for the nuclear waste disposal of the decommissioned Connecticut Yankee nuclear plant in Haddam, Connecticut. Joe Besaid was the most remarkable man I have ever known. Joe Besaid was a blacklisted former union foreman and a steam fitter at the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant in Waterford, Connecticut. He was one of the original whistleblowers that forced the closing of the Millstone plant in 1996. Joe testified about the corporate and political corruption surrounding the building of the plant and its continued operation. In In 2001, I had completed a five-part television series on documentary on the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone and a remarkable people who fought so hard for 5 years to close the plant and continue to fight to this day to keep the plant closed. Joe was the spirit behind the movement. His courage and tenacity kept the movement together. He gave other whistleblowers the help and courage they needed to finally expose the horrid dangers, massive corruption, and incompetence of the politicians, the Department of Public Utility Control, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the corporate criminals and incompetence that built the plant and operated the Waterford facility. Joe Bassade filmed over 10,000 hours of public meetings and helped produce a weekly television series on the New London cable access system that exposed the findings and aired the public meetings Joe had filmed. His program interviewed numerous politicians, nuclear and medical experts, all relating to the dangers of the Millstone Power Plant. Joe Bassade and Sal Mangiali, co-founder of CAN, Coalition Against Nuclear Energy, representing the Connecticut anti-nuclear activists, had just completed a tour across the U.S. in a Winnebago, filming the route chosen by the NRC for the transport of the nuclear waste from the Connecticut Yankee plant and the Millstone plant, destined for Yucca Mountain in Nevada. This insane plan was coined by nuclear activists as the Mobile Chernobyl. The plan called for hundreds of long flatbed trucks to carry concrete encased high radiation spent nuclear fuel rods through major cities and highways from the coast of Connecticut to the final destination of Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Joe and Sal's Winnebago had a sign on its sides that read, or that said, "We are following the route of the Mobile Chernobyl." They stopped in every town on the route to inform the residents their town was on the direct route for the trucks that would be carrying highly radioactive nuclear waste. Neither I nor anyone else knew that Joe had been recently diagnosed with cancer. 6 months after this interview, our second show, Joe Bassade would be dead. Joe is a great man, and I am very proud to have known him. Call him my friend. Miss him greatly. Shortly after my interview with Catholic worker Jackie Allen Dassault, the phone started to ring persistently in the outer office. While Lila was reading a news item, I went out of the studio to answer the phone. I answered, saying, "WQQQ." The male caller said, "Is this L.A. Steele?" "Yes," I replied. He then said, "You and your group should go to Iraq and have your tongues cut out and bleed in the streets. You're full of shit and don't have the balls to fight for your country." I was taken back a second and then yelled at him over the phone, saying, "You asshole, is this a threat?" He replied, "Yeah, and I'm going to cut your fucking tongues out, you bastards." I saw red and railed into him with full voice, then carried into the studio and over the microphone. "If you or any of your fucking redneck friends harm any member of my staff or try to harm me, I swear to God, I will hunt you down, find you, reach into your throat, pull out your heart, and feed it to the nearest dog." And slammed down the telephone and went to the studio, got on the microphone, and said, "We just got a threat. Some bastard wants to cut out our tongues. I'm going to say on the air what I said to him on the phone, except clean it up a little for the FCC. If anyone has any idea, I'm giving them fair warning. If any bastard dares to threaten or harm a member of my staff or me, I swear to God before all who are listening that I will hunt them down, find them, reach down their throats, pull out their hearts, and feed it to the nearest dog." As of this writing, which is more than 6 years since that incident occurred, I nor any member of my staff or show have had another threat. For some reason, we no longer get many angry callers either. On occasion, someone will take offense to what I say on the air, but they call the station in the morning rather than risk being mistaken by me as a threatening caller. This was only the second show on March 11th, 2003. Operation Enduring Freedom hadn't started yet, and there were still a few of us anti-war holdouts who thought we might still have a chance to stop the madness. All we did, it seems, was sing to the choir and make our listeners note that our group of liberals were committed activists, that L.A. Steel wasn't a pacifist or a pushover. I believe in peace and that war is wrong. I believe that death and destruction is the most insane method of solving any dispute. But if I or those I love are threatened, I will fight back. I can never back away from that stance. The final crisis of the evening of March 11, 2003 was, I had just been notified before the show that The Voice News was publishing its final printing. The Voice, my only sponsor, was going out of business. This came as a shock not only to me, but to everyone in Connecticut. 40,000 readers and the entire Voice staff, except for the publisher and founder. 3 weeks before that night, Jed Gulen had signed a 13-week contract with a radio station to sponsor my show. Now The Voice was closing its doors. Jed told me he would honor the contract with the station, and he made public statements in the news and local papers that he was going closing the paper he started 10 years prior. He gave all of his employees a generous severance and paid all of his suppliers on time and notified all of his regular contributors. I asked him why he was closing the doors, to which he said that it was time and he had other business plans to pursue. The Voice had become a hotbed of dissent since January 2003. And articles about anti-war rallies and radical anti-war, anti-Bush articles filled the Voice pages, shouting down, insulting, and virtually muting any conservative opinions by veterans writing and howling for war. Mothers were telling the radicals to honor their soldier sons. Idiots were telling everyone to believe in Bush and the government, right or wrong. The Voice News was a reader-contributing newspaper and one of the only in few in the country. Its subscribers and contributors were local, statewide, and national. The Voice, sponsoring the L.A. Steel Liberal Talk radio show, must have been too much for the ultra-conservative demographic to handle. Advertisers were threatening not to advertise, and the readers' articles were becoming angry and more vitriolic. And I am sure that if I received threats, Jed might have as well, but he never mentioned it. Jed closed the paper the following week and took his family on an extended vacation. I can't express greater appreciation to Jed Gould for his courage, compassion, and commitment to his staff and to the ideal of freedom of speech as the publisher of a great paper and the first sponsor of the L.A. Steel Show. All this happened just 1 week between two shows. 1 week later came shock and awe. The Bush administration said the war would be over in a month. GW flew in a fighter jet onto the deck of an aircraft carrier dressed in a fighter pilot uniform to declare victory in May 2003. 6 years later, America is still fighting in Iraq and has lost over 4,200 American soldiers and 30,000 are seriously wounded. An estimated 1 million Iraqis have lost their lives and 3 million are refugees. The cost of the Iraq War, as of 2009, has been estimated by the Government Accounting Office at a price of $3 trillion. Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, gave Congress an estimate of $60 billion for the entire conflict and victory in 1 month. Rumsfeld resigned in disgrace at the demand of Congress in November 2006. Chapter 2, The Stupidity Surrounding the Iraq War. Our third show was on March 18th, 2003, 2 days before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. GW had given Saddam Hussein 48 hours to give up his weapons of mass destruction, or the U.S. would invade his country. I believe Bush was bluffing, as did most of the world. The 48 hours was up the next day. The Iraq invasion began on 3/20/2003. I didn't take Bush seriously. That was the last time I misunderestimated G.W. Bush. That evening, as Lila and I drove up to the radio station before the show, we were met with a sobering, though extremely silly, symbol of pro-war sentiment parked in front of the station's door. It was apparent the message was meant for us. A half-ton pickup truck had in its back a large cardboard bomb erected on a carpenter's sawhorse, high enough to be seen over the cab. The cardboard bomb had "Nuke Iraq" written in large letters on each side. We didn't know whose truck it was, and we didn't care. We felt that the guy was stupid enough to drive around with a cardboard bomb taped in his truck, he wasn't anyone who could carry on a civil discussion about the war. The truck stayed in front of the station door for over an hour until the owner drove off. I locked the door after Lila and I entered. When Bill Marshall arrived in the studio that night, I unlocked the door and let him in, and locked it behind him. He was laughing at the cardboard nuke Iraq bomb and said, "You think he's talking to us?" Shortly later, the engineer arrived and knocked on the glass door window. I unlocked the door for him. He was obviously nervous when he walked in, but laughed and said, "I guess someone is listening to the show. I've heard a lot of people are talking about you." That evening was tense, but we knew that what we were doing was critical in getting the word out that the preemptive war was wrong and GW was an idiot. Under no circumstances would I back down or be intimidated as I called for Bush's impeachment for high crimes and treason and called him and every member of his administration every name allowable by the FCC. The third and fourth radio shows were at the beginning of the Iraq War. The country was in a state of shock. I found it hard to believe that millions of Americans supported the war. The Afghan invasion wasn't enough for the neocons. They and their red state supporters couldn't satisfy their bloodlust. The conflagration and insane firework display of the bombing of Baghdad was the most unbelievable and unnecessary display of overkill ever inflicted on any city or country by non-nuclear weapons since the bombing of Dresden in World War II. As I watched the horror of the shock and awe on television that evening, I imagined myself being in Baghdad and shuddered at the thought. I wondered what any Iraqi citizen or government official could have possibly done to warrant such destruction of their capital city. They had done absolutely nothing to warrant a preemptive strike or attack against the United States, To witness their obliteration by U.S. bombs was incomprehensible to me. It was like watching a video game or war movie. I thought, how could America, as a nation advocating freedom, democracy, and human rights, allow our leader and our military to obliterate another nation in our name without just cause or provocation? It is one of the greatest shames this country will ever bear. The abuses in Iraq began with 2 years of deplorable sanctions that devastated Iraq. The greatest abuse was the first night of bombing. The madness that has prevailed since has convinced the world of the insanity of our leaders. The support of the war by the U.S. population since then reveals the true hypocrisy and barbarism of the majority of people in the American society. I read on air for the fourth show, the first Iraq body count, 2009 known dead Iraqis. These were the first casualties reported by IraqBodyCount.org, a website dedicated to reporting the numbers of deaths in Iraq. These accounts were gathered from newsmen and women and some major news organizations to counter with accuracy the government counts of civilian casualties. First five Iraqi civilians killed in the war were from a U.S. missile striking a bus carrying five innocent civilians. The 209 civilian deaths total was the unofficial report by IraqBodyCount.org. NBC reporter David Bloom was to die the following week from an unexplained blood clot. The clot was suspected to have developed from a mandatory injection of an experimental anthrax vaccine that killed or disabled numerous soldiers, and was later found to affect the mental stability of 25% of all who received the vaccine. This program is recorded, and all reports can be verified by audio and written documents. David Bloom was a sad casualty. However, I always felt his Bloom-mobile was the most moronic, dangerous, and demonic idea ever spawned by a television network for the promotion of a war. We cannot forget that GE is the parent company of NBC and one of the largest defense contractors in the world. Watching David Bloom ride in an open flat bed across the barren desert with attached cameras recording every minute of his eating sand and spitting out dirt with a smile on his face and eating his dehydrated K-rations with the troops as though they were on a Boy Scout hike was the most insensitive and dangerous recruiting technique ever undertaken by any government. David Bloom made war look like a fun ride in a dune buggy. Just a few guys in a armored vehicle geared up and ready to fight a wicked dictator and bring to Iraq the neocon American dream of death, devastation, and their theft of the Iraqi oil fields. Why not join up? It was only supposed to last a month. Alas, the propaganda mobile crashed and burned with David Bloom's untimely death. It couldn't have been more ironic or symbolic. A foolhardy, ambitious reporter on his idiot mobile died promoting the most fraudulent war ever begun by the United States. There was no more grandstanding and glory boy reporting after his death. Then the casualties began to mount up and the war turned into a bloodbath for millions of Iraqis. The rest is history, and the death of U.S. soldiers and civilians in Iraq still dominate the headlines. David Bloom's name is seldom mentioned anymore, unless it is added to hundreds of others in his profession who accidentally died in Iraq or were deliberately targeted and killed by insurgents and the U.S. military. I spoke about this on the air when it happened and stated that Bloom was a poster boy for Army recruitment who died a fool's death. He may have possibly caused the death or decision to join the military of thousands of patriotic, naive young men who thought fighting in Iraq might be a fun adventure. The mainstream media and press have always aggravated me. The vast majority of Americans depend upon the mainstream media to present a fair and accurate accounting of current events. Well-informed Americans and people around the world once had faith in the American media, though an extremely misplaced faith. As I began to thoroughly research the output of many mainstream news outlets on a daily basis to find the items to talk about or read on the radio show, I realized that what I had suspected all my life, that the news we take seriously in America is a mixture of fact, fiction, outright lies, government and corporate propaganda, woven together by an inside editor, like the present and former voices of American news, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, Brian Williams, Wolf Blitzer, and countless other associate writers, producers, editors, and reporters. Anyone who tries to determine real news from unreal news knows what a tedious and torturous effort it is. The proof of my statement came on June 5th, 2003. New York Times editor, executive editor Howell Raines and managing editor Gerald Boyd resigned after several scandals destroyed the New York Times' credibility. The Jason Blair scandal of his fabrication of over 30 articles was suspected and allowed by these editors. Star reporter Brick Bragg resigned after stating that he used the work of inexperienced young reporters and gave them no credit for the bylines. Then came the Judith Miller scandal. Her false statements were fed to her by Karl Rove and others in the Bush administration and known embezzler Ahmad Chalabi. Chalabi was prepositioned by the Bush boys to be the new president of Iraq. Well, Miller's articles in the New York Times paved the way for a Bush team to invade Iraq. Her 85 days in jail for not revealing her source weren't enough. 85 years would be more in line with treason. I would have accepted any and even division of an 85-year sentence between her editors, publisher, and herself. my daily search for news and facts, I search at least 2 to 3 liberal and conservative news outlets on the net. My favorite liberal news blog are legitgov.org, davidicke.com. Both of those founders and editors I've had on my radio show. My right-wing reports are from Newsmax.com, Limbaugh, and Fox News. You seem to create a fair view of the news from both sides of the left and right brain. I review the Washington Post, RawStory.com, and BradBlog.com, and several international news outlets for breaking news. TheCornerReport.com, published by Gail Townsend, is a news site for Palestinian issues and news releases, as well as Connecticut and international indigenous news. Over the past many years, I've learned not to trust the major news outlets. New York Times and Washington Post are two major players. The Wall Street Journal can be interesting if you like the stock quotes and right-wing editorial writers. Now that Rupert Murdoch owns it, it's just another New York Post or Daily News. Any talk show host who prides themselves on being real with their listeners and having accurate and insightful news and commentary has to believe that anything else but being real just isn't worth the effort. Being real to your audience may cost you sponsors or may make people angry at you, but I can't think of doing the show any differently. In 2003, the world needed a free voice to escape from the right-wing squeal we were forced to listen to. Political correctness and godless evangelism was all that was heard on radio and television. The neocon, bush-belching idiots were everywhere. War! We love war! Support our troops! Liberals are traitors! Liberalism is communism! Nuke Iraq! I give the devil his due when I admit Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and Sean Hannity are inspirations to me. When I listen to them, I realize that I am dead right in my suspicions about the conservative con game media. Their outrageous statements and right-wing Republican rhetoric attacking the peace movement and liberalism gives me the right to lash out at the Republican and conservative propaganda push. By May of 2003, I was starting to make headway in the market area. People were starting to realize that the northwest corner of Connecticut, southern Massachusetts, and upstate New York had real freedom of speech on the radio, at least on WQQQ 103.3 FM. That someone could say what I was saying about Bush and his minions by bashing the war and all of its sponsors and supporters with aggressive, liberal, accurate, verbal attacks was amazing at the time. The shout-out against the lies and deceit leading up to the war and denouncing G.W. Bush and company as conspirators and traitors for their organizing the events of 9-1-1 was unheard of yet on commercial radio in America, especially in an area of staunch Bush Republicans and mild-mannered Democrats. The local Republican establishment tried to ignore the show early on. Local pseudo-intellectual artists and intellectuals shunned the show and stood me up on several occasions without apology or cancellation. I mocked them on the program when I heard some had canceled because they were afraid to be associated with a radical show. The Ellie Steele Show was getting popularity, and many locals were too afraid to discuss their views on radio for fear of a local backlash. By the summer of 2003, one outspoken Republican in the era couldn't stand me anymore and decided to write a letter to the local newspaper denouncing the Ellie Steele Show and its irreverent liberal outbursts. Shortly after the letter was published, he was hired as an editor of the paper. Letters to the editor in this local paper are well read. The opinion section often had a full-page letter of William Buckley Jr. and another full-page editorial by the former publisher. Other non-political local letters were squeezed in between the two until the full-page article bashing the L.A. Steele Show was printed and squeezed against Bill Buckley's rambling letter in support of Bush and the Iraq War, a view of which Buckley did an about-face from in the same paper in 2005. The Bush-loving Republican wrote a comparison of the L.A. Steele Show to the Rush Limbaugh Show, comparing how Limbaugh used satire and humor when he bashed anyone he didn't like, where I, on the other hand, was too serious and angry and not at all funny, as were my co-host Lila and show astrologer Bill Marshall and my outspoken guests. He disliked our pointed sarcasm and the seriousness of our discussions and the disrespect of conservative and established opinions on Iraq and Afghan wars. He went on and on for five columns until he finally droned out. I didn't respond to the letter in writing or verbally. I ignored it. Actually, I admit I was impressed that I raised enough controversy to be libeled in the local paper. It was very good PR and great for our local ratings. If people in the area didn't know about the show by then, they did after reading the article. This same Bush lover wrote another article several months later attacking the show again. I again ignored it, hoping it would raise my ratings further. This was the kind of publicity I couldn't pay for. My station manager told me after he read the letter in the paper, I guess any publicity is good publicity. A few years after this letter appeared, I was told by several people that the newspaper publisher wrote a local blog linked to the paper and that I was a moral degenerate in response to my calling the paper a two-bit rag on the air that night before. I criticized the paper for not accepting my public notice for views from the West Bank, which was a free and open to the public panel discussion on Palestinian issues with an expert panel. The seminar was sponsored by my company, Steelwood Media, to be held at the local library. I tried to submit the announcement for their free community calendar on three separate occasions and was ignored until one of the panelists finally hand-delivered the announcement herself, and they still did not print it. Any pro-Palestinian issues are never printed in this newspaper. I laughed for a week after I was told about the and later read her moral degenerate comment. The seminar was a success, with many concerned people attending, and I filmed the entire seminar to air on local and statewide community access stations. Since then, our ratings have continued to grow exponentially, and there hasn't been another mention of the L.A. Steel Show in the paper, which in many ways I am thankful for. Perhaps one of the most bizarre things that happened at the Views from the West Bank seminar, with the exception of one individual walking out after insulting one of the panelists, was a comment made to me personally by one of the attendees. He was a Palestinian who had traveled many miles to hear this discussion and, not being familiar with the town, had stopped at the town green to ask the Saturday morning anti-war protesters gathered for a vigil on the town green where the library was. They informed him not to go to the seminar because it was sponsored by me, and I was an anti-Zionist and a conspiracy theorist. These were the self-proclaimed progressive Democrats of the community. Amazing. By the sixth week of the radio show, I was faced with a major dilemma. At 5 o'clock on the evening of the show, 3 hours before airtime, I got a call from the station's secretary. She told me that my engineer canceled at the last minute and there wasn't anyone to cover for him. The show would have to be canceled or it would have to be taken off the air for the night. I had already scheduled author Greg Balas for the show for a live phone interview. This was to be one of the first radio interviews scheduled by his publicist for his first book and bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I didn't want to cancel him or tell him the show was canceled that night because my engineer didn't show up, and I didn't know how to operate the studio phones or the control board. I needed to talk to Joe, the station manager, and he had gone home for the day before the engineer canceled. The office secretary gave him his own phone number to call him, but said he might not be home until 6 o'clock. I was starting to panic a little. I called Joe and left a message for him to call me back as soon as possible. 20 minutes later, he called me and said I would have to cancel the show unless I could learn to engineer the show myself. He had a meeting to go to that night. I told him I would if he told me how. He gave the explicit instructions on how to operate the board, but I was still confused about how to use the studio phones to conduct the interview. I had no choice but to go through with it or cancel the show for the night. I knew from my television experience an audience needs to have confidence that when they tune into a new program, it will be on the air at the time they expect it to be. Whether the show is good, bad, or a repeat, the new audience expects it, and I couldn't afford to disappoint them. It would be extremely difficult to regain their confidence. went well with a few minor problems. Lila, my level-headed liberal co-host, said to me before we went on the air, after I did a sound check, "Don't touch anything, and we will just keep talking." The interview with Greg Palast was a little shaky at first, and I accidentally hung up on him and called him back immediately. I apologized and thanked him for his patience. That night I learned a lot about his famous sense of humor. Northwest Connecticut is always known as a Republican stronghold, full of strong conservative values. My uncensored rants accusing the Bush boys of treason for plotting 9-1-1 and calling for a Bush impeachment on every show may have been too much for my sound engineer. He did me a great favor by not showing up for that program. I gained full control of the program ever since. I have to admit, it took a few weeks for me to feel comfortable at the controls. My radio engineering IQ became obvious to other DJs in my audience. A moment or two of sudden radio silence became known as a steel moment. I first heard this term used as I was driving home one afternoon listening to a drive-time DJ on the rival local station. He fumbled for a few seconds as he changed songs and excused himself for his error by saying, "Sorry, folks, I was having a steel moment." You know you are being listened to when your competition references your famed incompetence to cover their own. I admit I was insulted at first hearing it, but I immediately started to laugh so hard I nearly ran off the road. I began to imagine how many times I must have fumbled at the microphone while trying to change a CD or having miscued a song at the break, made a sudden correction on the air, or mistakenly forgot to turn on or off one of the microphones, even my own. I was never very good at multitasking. I guess others have noticed that flaw in me as well. I discovered that my listeners were far more loyal, or at least more curious than I had ever expected. As a new talk show host, everyone waits for you to fail, thinking you won't last long, or they ask how I can get away with talking like that, like I do, saying such things about the president or senators, congressmen, or the governor. How dare I have the audacity to call Republicans corrupt, perverted, and incompetent? How dare I say those things? They all knew that I said them loud and clear, made no apologies for stating them. I attacked Republicans and Democrats alike. Shortly after the 2004 election, I interviewed Gene Stone, author of the Bush Survival Guide. In the interview, he became frustrated with me and said he was noted as a fierce liberal, but I was more liberal than he was. I had attacked his support for progressive Democrats and said the movement was a waste of time and a progressive Democrat was an oxymoron. I had been shouting curses at the entire corrupt system on commercial radio since March 4th, 2003, 1 year before America entering the height of the conservative control of all media. I guess I made a few people nervous. I know I made my station manager nervous. For the first 7 or 8 weeks of the program, my station manager would call me an hour before showtime and ask who I had on as a guest and request that I tone my rants down a little. He was getting a few complaints. I would tell him who my guests were and assure him I wouldn't swear or say anything obscene. He would criticize my statements and my interviews if he didn't agree with them. But after we received a few complimentary emails from our listeners and a few local compliments were given to him personally for keeping the show on, he became more confident in what I was doing and said that he was beginning to enjoy fielding complaints about me and defending freedom of speech. There aren't too many Joe Laveros in the business. If there were, the world of radio would be a better place. I have to commend Dennis Jackson, the owner of WQQQ 103.3 FM, and give Dennis and Joe all due respect for their great courage, support, and friendship over these last 6 years. That's the end of chapter 3, 2, rather. And I got through it a little quicker than I expected to. really don't have time to go through chapter four or chapter three. But what I do have, I may give you a treat tonight, is I might read one of my essays, a short essay. The book has 166 essays in it. And read one. And it's from, they're all from my website, lasteelshow.org. And in fact, I think what I'll do, instead of reading an essay, I think I'll just read the introduction to Essays and Insights. Essays and Insights, which is part two of this book. The website LA Steel Show was established, Essays and Insights, rather, I should say, 2004 to 2009. The website LASteelShow.org was established in November 2004. 166 essays and insights were selected from over 500 published online works written since November 4th until August of 2009. To present the range of topics selected in this book, it was necessary to divide the essays into six categories: national politics, international politics, patriotism, satire, mainstream media, and metaphysics. The publication date for each essay and insight is printed next to each title to note the historical perspective. The original works are available in the lasteelshow.org public archives. My author's note is, I thank Rob Brinkman, designer and webmaster of lasteelshow.org, for our long friendship and his remarkable gift. I can't thank Rob enough for setting that up for me. And he did it as a gift. He did it for nothing. Just to get me going with this thing, because he believed in what I was doing. And for that, I thank him very much. And he continues to update he continues to be a webmaster for the website. National politics. 81 essays and insights. And the titles, there's actually 81 titles. I have about 2 minutes left on this show, so I got a feeling I won't be able to get through them all. There's international politics, 19 essays there. Satire, 26 essays there. And mainstream media, 9 essays about the mainstream media. And patriotism, 11 essays and insights. And the last category is metaphysics, and there I have 20 essays and insights. And afterward as well. So I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I hope the book should be coming out toward the end of this month, which is December. If you have a Facebook page, please go to LA's or check out mine, which would be Leo Steel. On Facebook is Leo Steel, and there's a copy of my of the book there, the front cover and back cover of the book, the proofs, and also there's 25 or 6 pictures that are actual inserts in the book that are on an album there on my Facebook page. So I hope that you I hope that you'll check that out. And don't forget to check out our shows tomorrow night as well, when we have George Dixon joining us, and we'll be talking about the sixth night of the Mayan calendar, getting ourselves up to date on what's on the timeline here, the 2012. So I want to thank everybody, and hope you had a good night, and talk to you tomorrow night. You might join me with Lila and